This episode is brought to you by NordVPN. Listen up, nerds. No. Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, from border to border and coast to coast and all the ships at sea.
What?
Hello, friends. Do you have a computer? Of course you do, because it's not 1987. Hell, you're listening to this on some kind of computer right now. But do you have a VPN?
Oh,
what's a VPN, you ask? Well, my friend, a VPN is a virtual private network and it offers two key benefits: enhanced privacy and security online. But VPNs do a lot more than that. VPNs shield your IP address, change your browsing location, and make online life easier. It's all about safety and security, my friends. But like everything else in life, it's also about watching TV. Don't let your paid subscriptions go to waste. I use NordVPN to access my home content while I'm traveling. Wink, wink. Plus, secure your connection on public Wi-Fi in airports, hotels, cafes, anywhere you go when you're traveling. There's over 6,300 servers in 111 countries, and you can find a nearby server for the best VPN speeds. NordVPN is easy to use. Connect with one click or enable auto-connect for zero-click protection. And it's got amazing speed. NordVPN is one of the fastest VPNs out there. And with just one NordVPN account, you can use it on 6 devices. It supports every major platform: Windows, Android, iOS, macOS, Linux, even Android TV. I think those are all real. Don't miss out on all the awesome benefits for using a VPN. Go to nordvpn.com/ifanboy today for a risk-free 30-day money-back guarantee. The link's in the show notes. Once again, that's nordvpn.com/ifanboy.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You ever feel like you really need to get something off your chest? This is like a real thing. Like, if you're mad, if you're upset, if there's something going on, like there's often for me an idea. Maybe it's a wrong. Maybe it's a moment. It's an injustice. It's something that just you keep going on and on, over and over in your mind about it, and like that can create anger and resentment or shame, whatever it is. And very often, I have found, I am not a therapist, I have found that when you let it out, when you give it voice, when you say it out loud, sometimes it makes you feel better because you've expressed it. And sometimes it makes you realize like, oh, this is not a big deal, but it's been stuck in my head. So you give voice to those things, and it can make you feel a lot better. And shock of all shocks, therapy is one of those things that can help you do that. It can help you be able to say those things in a place where you don't need to worry about the repercussions of it, work your way through it, figure out coping skills, how to get around it, you know, find ways to deal with that stuff instead of letting it fester. If you are thinking of starting therapy, if anything I said sounds familiar, you're like, oh, maybe my life would be a little better if I could deal with that kind of thing, you should give BetterHelp a try. It's fully online. It is convenient, flexible. It is suited to your schedule. That's the idea. That's what they're going for. You can fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. That's a big deal. You can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. That personal connection, I believe, to be super important. Again, I'm not a professional. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/ifanboy today. You get 10% off your first month. That is BetterHelp, HELP.com/ifanboy.
You are listening to ifanboy.com's Talksplode. Today, we're talking to John Arcudi, writer of BPRD, Aliens, Predator, Marvel's USA Comics 70th Anniversary Special, and Superman in DC's Wednesday Comics Project.
I run the numbers through the floor. Here's how it goes. I crack the codes. I crack the codes in the war. I crack the codes in the war.
Oh. Hey there, the world. It's me, Paul Montgomery, for ifanboy.com. Of course, you know Josh Flanagan. And joining us today is John Arcudi, writer of BPRD, Wednesday Comics, Superman Story, and a whole bunch of other stuff. So let's get right into it. John, now everyone seems to cannonball into the industry a little differently. How did you break into comics?
Drinking. I was really good friends with a guy who was friends with Pat Redding, who was an assistant editor up at Marvel. And we were just having beers one night, and she came walking up and started talking to him and to me, and they just happened to need somebody to fill in for Savage Tales, 8-pager, I think it was, I'm not sure, but it doesn't really matter, it's a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I came up and I talked to Larry, and that was it.
What kind of aspirations did you have before that? I mean, you hadn't considered writing for comics? Oh, okay.
No, I actually was doing prose writing before that. So I had a lot of experience writing, which is why Pat considered me in the first place. He found out that I was a writer, and I wasn't really going very far in prose writing. And as you could probably tell, drinking a stoop, I wasn't trying very hard. So she just took it on her. She decided to see if comics was going to work for me, maybe better than prose, just by virtue of needing a writer and me being there. And it seems it worked out. It was a good fit, a lot better fit than I thought it would be, frankly.
So you had never really intended to do that? You just sort of started doing it?
Yeah, not really. I mean, I was a comics reader, and I probably, you know, messed around a little with it. I don't really remember very clearly, but it wasn't really, I wasn't aiming to do it. It was sort of that. It's the way it used to be, you know. This stuff sort of happens by chance. You guys don't take classes at Drexel University to learn how to do it.
Well, that doesn't happen now at all. I mean, it's, to break into comics writing now, it's a torturous road.
Yeah, well, it may have been if I had been trying to at the time, mm-hmm. you know. It just was serendipitous. And as I said, it turned out to be a really good fit. Every year on her birthday, I call Patty Redding and thank her for that.
Was it hard to pick up like the language of comics, or did that come to you fairly easily? Did you work in Marvel style back then?
I'm trying to remember that first couple of scripts. The first script I wrote, I'm pretty sure was a full script because Larry sat down and taught me how to write full script. But then after that, I worked Marvel style for a bit. And I, as I said, I've been writing quite a bit, but they're two different animals, prose and comics. Sure. And Larry sort of, in his inimitable fashion, but effective, whipped me into shape for writing the first story. And then thereafter, writing Marvel style was a lot easier because it put the burden on the artist for the storytelling, mm-hmm. which is, you know, why no one does it anymore. I don't know if that's true or not, but at Marvel, when I write for Marvel, they want full scripts. Mm-hmm. So
when did you feel as if you'd sort of like hit your stride writing for comics and realized it was sort of like the point of no return?
Wow, that's a cheery way of looking at it. I don't really know. It was like anything, I guess, in life. It was sort of gradual, and then you turn around and, you know, look about you and like, oh, okay, I guess this is what I'm doing. So it took a few years before I realized where I was rather than, you know, any kind of a one day waking up and saying, this is it. You know, but it took a few years before I realized that this is what I was doing, was what I was good at, and I might as well stick with it.
I know you for writing a lot of sort of like pulp influenced adventure and horror, and like recently in a BPRD issue, I loved seeing that footnote translated from Hyperborean. Were the pulps and like Robert E. Howard like a big influence on you, both as, you know, as a reader and then later as a writer?
I sure loved Robert E. Howard stuff, you know, when I was in high school, which is, you know, it's when you're supposed to love it. And I wouldn't say that it was that great an influence on me. I did write some Conan stuff for Marvel, but I wouldn't say that Howard was a great influence on my writing, not even my Conan writing. You read it and you didn't want to disgrace the character or anything. But no question that I liked it a lot. Yeah, and you know, Barry Smith, John Buscema, Conan, it's hard to find better comics than that.
Well, what were your influences coming into comics?
I wasn't really trying to write comics, and so my real influences were from other places, like Charles Williford, primarily Charles Williford, and a lot of film too, John Ford, more than anybody probably. Charles Williford, I don't know if you're familiar with his stuff. He wrote the Hoke Mosley novels, Miami Blues, New Hope for the Dead, those kinds of things. He's in the same sort of vein as Jim Thompson, but a little more, I don't know, his style is even more transparent than Thompson's. It's hard to describe, but that was what I was always hoping to do is try not to have my fingerprints all over what I did. And that's the great thing about collaboration. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but that's the great thing about collaboration is that the author kind of disappears in the background. And I like that. I think that if the story is good, then the story will keep the reader. And my personality or my flourishes or whatever the hell you want to call it, I don't know. I mean, that's a trick you can only keep up for so long. And I don't like it anyway, you know. That's why I really like John Ford and Charles Williford. You can't really, after a while, when you're in that storytelling mode, reading or watching a movie, you don't really think about who created it. And that's what I like about that's the best kind of story there is, where you're just communicating ideas and nothing about yourself.
So ideally, you would want... You know, you wouldn't want somebody to read something that you wrote and be able to identify it with your name specifically?
Not specifically, no. I mean, you know, I, if they read it and they like it and they look and they see John Arcudi, I want them to go and buy more John Arcudi work. But no, I don't want them to, you know, like Hitchcock, for instance, you know, you can't help but tell that Hitchcock directed almost anything that he directed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people love that about Hitchcock. But, you know, to me, that's a sign of someone who's communicating his personality rather than ideas that are universal, you know?
Putting the messenger before the message.
Exactly.
So you talked about collaboration. You worked on The Mask and Cracked Magazine, and it sort of strikes me that would be like very really visual ideas, like sort of like writing like a Looney Tunes cartoon with all the sight gags and everything. Did that involve a lot of maybe even closer collaboration between you and the artist you were working with for that kind of material?
Well, it varies. With Doug, I wrote very detailed scripts. And I remember one of the first conversations I had with Mike Mignola. He was like, did you write this right here? Did you write this specifically, this scene? And I was like, yeah, that's what I wrote. And Doug, but Doug interpreted it. I don't want to take anything away from what Doug did because, you know, in 100 other artists' hands, it would have been, you know. But then, you know, as I got a little more, mature, or whatever, the collaborations became a little more relaxed, and I trusted my artist a little more. And it cracked when you're working with John Severin. If you can't trust John Severin, there's something wrong with all of us. So, you know, that was earlier on before I did Cracked, and my editor was like, you know, don't be an idiot. You know, trust John Severin, trust Steve Ditko, you know, trust Gene Colan, you know.
It's probably pretty good advice.
It was good advice, yeah. And the thing is, ideally, if you come up with a good story and you work with the right guy, he's going to be able to tell that story differently from the way you would have anyway. And as I said, you know, if you work with a good artist, you know, woman or man, I shouldn't say guy, I suppose, they're going to find a better way to tell that story. You know, and that's what I'm really comfortable with now, is working with the best possible people. Yeah, who wouldn't be? But letting them have a little more room to tell the story in a way that the reader can access it better than I can, because they know what's going to sell on the page, not sell, but work on the page in terms of art. And one would hope that I still know what's going to work. Dialogue.
I suppose that working on something like BPRD, where, I mean, I've seen what to me are very sort of elegant yet simple sort of page layouts and stuff. Are you fairly hands-off with how that goes? Do you describe panel layout at all, or do you just sort of say, you know, there's four or five panels on this, and here's what happens in each of them, and leave it to Guy Davis? Or?
No, I still do full script. Very, very rarely will I sort of back off and say, look, this page, you know, handle the way you want to. But, you know, but then Guy comes in and he lays it out, and we all look at it. Mike, Scott Alley, the editor, and I, we all look at it. And, you know, he's going to make changes because many, many, many times he really has to. You know, I think very visually, but not as visually as obviously Guy Davis will. And he'll change it. And if it's not working, we'll all talk about it. And if it is working, we just let it go. So, I try to give any artist as much guidance as I can with where this story should be going. And if he can find something that works better, by all means, please do it. He has that, and not only that, latitude, that's his obligation, in my opinion. And if he can find a way to make the story go a different way that improves the way to tell a story, you know, by all means. You know, that those artists, frankly, are rare, which is why I work so much with Guy Davis.
Yeah.
That really improve the story. You know, it's not a kick against artists. It's just a difficult synergy to get going, you know.
So continuing in the vein of BPRD, the Bureau has been around for a really long time, basically since the early 90s with the earliest Hellboy stuff. But could you talk about a little bit about how you came on board the actual BPRD ongoing series like a decade later? How did you hook up with Dark Horse and with Mike Mignola?
Well, Mike and I have been... you don't read the introductions to those collections.
Not everybody listening has. That's...
I know. I'm just fucking with you. Mike and I have been talking a long time about collaborating on something, and I can't even remember all of the different things we talked about. We talked about working for DC. At one point, we were talking to the Cartoon Network about doing something together. You know, a lot of different permutations of collaboration that we discussed. And then independently, not quite as long, but independently, Guy and I were trying to work together. And we were trying to do something at DC, you know, blah, blah, blah. And in spite of the fact that Mike and I both talked about how great Guy was, it didn't come to us right away until a little later that all three of us getting together was going to make this happen a little faster. And, you know, Mike had already decided that he wanted to launch the BPRD with a series of series with Plague of Frogs, and he talked to me about you know, taking over from there, and it just was, you know, again, serendipitous, although you could call us all very slow-witted for not figuring it out, you know, a year or two earlier.
So what's the collaborative relationship like on a script, say? Like, what's the process from beginning to end? Like, how do you work on it? How do you, you know, bring Guy in and everything?
Every series has been different. The first series that I did with Mike, I wrote my story, Mike wrote his story. Mike just gave me a plot, and I incorporated the plot, but into the full script. But it was a fairly clear division. Not fairly clear division. It was a clear division of labor as far as that goes. And then on the next series, Mike said, this is what we're going to do. And we had a conversation about what the Black Flame was going to be. And then I wrote the whole thing. And each series since then has been different. A couple of them I wrote almost completely on my own with a couple of suggestions from Mike. And a couple of them have been more collaborative in nature, such as the first two I described. But every one of them has been slightly different from the other. But generally, the even with Mike's involvement, I'm the one who will sit down and physically write the script, because Mike doesn't really like to do that.
I tend to think of him on those as like, I guess it's like an executive producer kind of role almost. Like he gives the notes, but you would be like the showrunner. I mean, in TV terms, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And sometimes his involvement is far greater than others. As I said, a couple of the series, he didn't know what was going on in the books until, you know, Scott edited the scripts and would send them on. And, you know, he just trusted me, and he still trusts me, and I hope he still trusts me after this interview. But then we turn it all over to Guy, Scott first, and we go through it, you know, do some notes, and then we turn it all over to Guy, and Guy submits layouts, and we all look at it. He sends them to me, to Mike, to Scott, and Scott's assistants, and we all look at it, and generally, just as with every script, there'll be a few notes for Guy. Never anything big, unless, you know, there's a real communication breakdown. And then Guy from there goes straight to pencils and goes. Because this guy is not only is Guy very good, he's very, very fast. So we were really lucky in that regard, because we didn't have to. The layouts help us. The layouts help us keep a storytelling consistency going, and be really left out as far as that goes. I don't know that any. There must be other artists out there that can do that, can turn layouts and then pencils and inks in the same short period of time that Guy can. But I don't know that they'd be as good as Guy. You know, we're just really, really lucky.
I imagine at this point, you know, like you've all been doing this for a while, you know, and it's a pretty core group, so it must be. I'm guessing it's a fairly painless process compared to, say, a lot of other work that maybe either you've done or, you know, you're used to seeing, I guess, in a lot of mainstream comics. Somebody's a jerk.
What's that? And you know, someone is going to be a jerk every now and again. I've been a jerk now and again. It's you know, we're all human beings. But it's been a relatively, for me anyway, and I think probably Guy would say the same thing, a couple of hiccups. It's been a relatively painless process almost from the beginning, because we all know what we want to do. And the editor is sort of on board with that because he's working so closely with Mike. As you say, Mike sort of serves the function of an executive producer. But it's always hard. I got to be honest with you. You know, Hemingway said, easy writing makes for hard reading. And I'm sure, you know, as fast as Guy is, every now and again, it's a challenge. You know, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing. You don't want it to be easy. You don't want to write stories that, you know the ending to before, you know. I'm sort of getting ahead of myself, but you want to make sure that the readers are as surprised by your stories as you would like them to be, and as surprised by the images as you would like them to be, and by the ideas and all that. And so it's always I don't want to call it a grind, but it's always relatively difficult. Generally speaking, if I'm having fun, doesn't mean it isn't difficult.
It's interesting because on my side as a reader, you know, with the BPRD stuff, it feels very effortless. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but like the pages are not blocked. The characters don't have to explain too much. It's, did I say blocked? They're just not all, you know, full of too much stuff. And I guess that's a testament to sort of the craft that you guys put into it. But, you know, they come out that way. It's not that the story's boring or anything like that, but it just feels like the books flow really well and are really interesting. So I guess there's a lot more to that than most of us.
Well, know. Yeah, thanks. And that's always what we're trying for. It's nice to know that we're succeeding. But it's not, I know you didn't mean that as an insult, but I hope this doesn't sound flippant, but yeah, it doesn't happen by accident, you know.
It's, sure. It's,
and Guy again is a really big part of that because his stuff is simultaneously sick and insane and yet blue collar. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, you look
Absolutely.
At these guys. Yeah, you look at his work and you're like, this. You know, he's not trying to, you know, devastate me with, you know, insane panel layout. You know, and he's just trying to tell a story, and that's really, really, really important. You know, and that's, I work with a lot of artists, and some of them are more interested in drawing than telling a story. And Guy Davis, if you want him to draw, just draw something, just draw a drawing, you know, he can do that great. But man, the guy's, when he's doing a comic, what he wants to do is tell a story, and it comes out exactly as you say. It flows beautifully, you know.
Now, since you're working under, I guess, this Hellboy universe umbrella, and in a way it has to sort of be shaped to fit under the way that, you know, Mignola did the Hellboy comics before and things like that. Has that ever been difficult for you, like fitting in with that style, or do you feel that you just sort of like you write in that way sort of naturally anyway?
It's interesting because you know, Mike and I were talking about this not too long ago actually, and I don't really feel as if I am writing anything like the way Mike does. I think it's just by virtue of having done it for as long as I've done it that people think it's sort of it falls into that Hellboy universe. But if you read Darkness Calls or what's the most recent one, Wild Hunt,
yeah.
they tend to be far more.
Those books feel, you know, more sparse, sort of, I guess.
Well, they're weird and lyrical, and I don't know that anybody, and maybe they'd say that BPRD is weird, although I try to unweirdify it as much as I can, but I don't think anybody would call it lyrical. Mm-hmm. And as Mike keeps saying it, you know, you show all the nuts and bolts, John, you know, and I think that's probably true. I want to make this stuff, I want to make it weird and terrifying. But I want you to understand these are real people going out there and getting their heads torn off, even if they're, you know, gas in a, you know, a ghost in a bag, mm-hmm. you know. And you know, Hellboy is, he's, you know, he's the beast of the apocalypse, and this, you know, he makes it, you know, Mike has him talking like he's a regular guy, and he reacts to it like a regular guy, but everything around him is as I said, this kind of eerie lyrical quality to the work in general.
It sort of makes sense that BPRD would be more Spartan, more matter of fact, because I mean it is a military organization.
No, it actually wasn't until I came on board. And I don't know how happy Mike was when he started out going in the direction, but now he's very happy with it. You know, if you go back and you look at the old Hellboys, it's a bunch of ghost hunters, you know. Mm. But I introduced an ex-Marine captain who brought a military discipline to it, and I also the threat is escalating, and so I just. That's how it came about. That it's now perceived as a you know, military organization.
Speaking of new characters, like how important is it to keep the? It feels like a revolving cast, and it feels like the dynamic is constantly changing. You know, in the best of ways with each new arc. So, how much of that is just like is that coming out of the story, or is that just your need to sort of keep things fresh?
Both, although I'd like to think, I mean, like bringing Daimyo on board at the beginning, we needed sort of somebody to replace Hellboy in the team dynamic. And so, you know, that was sort of a latter, you know, question. It's more to keep things fresh. But then bringing Panya in after Garden of Souls, it just seemed to make sense, you know. You introduce a good guy, so to speak, and... you know, you're not just going to leave her on the island, you know. And mm-hmm. So, I, for good or bad, I tend to look at stories as like, well, you know, you introduce this element, you can't just let it go. You know, you got to do something with it. Like Daryl, the Wendigo. You know, I introduced mm-hmm. him. Like, yeah, it was a flashback story, but you know, he's still out there in that Canadian maximum security prison. So you got to do something with him. So that was, it's just me being obsessive about not letting loose threads dangle, unless, of course, we really want them to dangle, in case anyone hears this and says, what are you fucking talking about, dude? But, you know, if there's a loose thread there that I think I can use for the story, I have to pick it up, you know.
Are most of those characters that you brought in, do you think those are... Were those characters, I guess, that came to you that you wanted to fit in, or it sounds more like you'd come up with a need for a character and then you'd create somebody for that hole?
Well, yeah, it's usually all about the story. Like, I want to tell a story about about Abe's old colleagues, conspirators, whatever it'll be, whatever you want to call them. And I needed, not a MacGuffin, but why was Abe going to go there? And so I needed a lure, and it turned out that lure is going to have to be a character. And to maybe be a little bit more honest about this, I have a lot of trouble writing other people's characters. Not always, but every now and again I do. And so if I introduce new characters, I feel a little bit more like it's my book. Although at this point I feel as if all those characters are my characters. So
are there any of those that you're particularly affectionate towards, I guess? Or, I mean, you have to do horrible things to them all the time.
Yeah. Well, you know, like what I just said, I said I feel like all of them are mine. I mean, Daimyo always was my favorite, and Daryl. Daryl's just—he's great. He's such a great character. I realize most people probably don't think of him as a character, but to me, he's a great character because he doesn't say anything after the first time we see him, but he's so important to the story. You know, kind of like the way people say, you know, the New York City is a character in the story. That's how I feel about Daryl. You know, he doesn't say anything, but he's really an important part of moving the story forward. But in terms of the originals, probably Johan. I'd loved Roger, but, you know, we killed him.
I, too, loved Roger. So.
Yeah. He was a lot of fun. I had a little trouble with him at first, but then I... really, really got to enjoy him, and just, you know, after just, I think, writing him really well for three issues, I killed him. Go figure.
It's funny because like that's like a realization you have to make. Like all of a sudden the story presents itself in the way like I have to kill this guy now. Or is...
Well, you know, Mike and I talked about it beforehand, and I didn't realize how much fun he was until I started writing him. But I already knew he was going to die for the Black Flame. I mean, I was having fun writing him towards the end of The Dead, but early on it was sort of like, you know, I just wasn't getting it. I think you can see that if you reread The Dead. But The Black Flame, I already knew he was going to, I don't know, maybe because I knew he was going to die, I could enjoy him more. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that, you know. It's something about me, whatever.
So how far in advance do you outline these stories? Basically, like right now in BPRD, you've just finished the second part of a trilogy, right? The Scorched Earth trilogy. So, how much of what's going on right now did you know about way back when you started?
Oh, we knew everything before I started writing. I knew where it was going to end up. But before I started writing The Warning, I knew where we were going to end up with King of Fear, which is the third. I'm just sorry that we couldn't get those three out in a row. It proved to be scheduling-wise a little too difficult. But I knew, you know, however long, I mean, more than a year ago, how it was all going to turn out. The Warning was the one that, you know, Mike said, well, you know, this happened in the first couple of issues. I'm not really sure where this should go. And I wrote the last three issues of The Warning. So if anybody doesn't like those crab robots, they can blame me. But Mike had a little more, he had some more specific ideas about a Black Goddess and King of Fear. And so I'm working from a couple of actually Mike wrote those down, some plots that he wrote out for those two. And then the one after King of Fear is going to be my story almost entirely with some input from Mike.
One of the things that I really appreciate as a reader is that whereas in other team books where they're sort of full of sacred cow, you know, superhero characters, I'm never worried about them getting offed. But with BPRD, I never know what's going to happen and who's safe and how long anybody's going to be part of the team for any particular length of time. And just thinking about Liz, who I've read that Mike was planning on killing her off very early on, even in the Hellboy books, and she stayed around, you know, this long. So, I mean, how we were talking about, you know, outlining and planning and everything. How much surprise is there? Like, is it, you know, exciting? You know, just sort of having these characters that could be blown to smithereens at any minute.
It's great, you know. It's a lot of fun, you know. And the other thing is that these characters are not. I'd like them to be as much as like real people as we can get away with, which is to say that, you know, real people are motivated by usually, you know, personal things. And that means that real people act really beneficently at times and selfishly at other times, and sometimes so selfishly as to, you know, border on or maybe even cross over into evil, and that's always a possibility with these characters too, that they're going to have reasons to maybe not be the nicest people, and not because, you know, the cosmic cube, but because, you know, Johan, you know, he was getting laid, you know, he getting laid after years of living in a plastic head, and you know, that's no good. You know, if someone takes that away from you, that's no good. You know, and you know, also in that series, he was being, you know, promiscuous. I don't know if he was practicing safe sex. You know, so it is no motivation that those characters have, generally speaking. You know, like Liz gets hypnotized by Mendon Sahn, stuff like that. But most of the characters' long-term motivations are the same motivations that any one of us would have, you know. Not necessarily any one of us who had a superpower would have, but any of us would have on any given day.
But let's talk about some of the other Dark Horse projects. You're working on the Alien series and Predator right. coming up. But Aliens number one is definitely out, and I really enjoyed that. And again, it's another situation. I don't want to give too much away for anybody who hasn't read the issue, but anything can happen.
If they haven't bought it by now, to hell with them. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
but reading that first issue, I was kind of lulled into a false sense of security, and then by the end, anything can happen in this book. This right. is no one is safe.
Yeah, that's the kind of stories I like to see, and that's the kind of stories I like to tell. And the aliens. I thought Predator was going to be more fun. But somehow, it turned out that Aliens was a lot more fun than I thought it was going to be to write. It was really a blast. I got to develop, some interesting characters and some, I hope, unusual motivations for those characters. Again, there are some people who are just people that maybe do things that are counter to their nature that could be perceived as bad, what will be perceived as bad. And hopefully by the end of the series, you'll understand why they did that. You have to have aliens in the story, but they don't do a lot of talking. So if you want to have any reason for there to be a story, it's got to be hopefully about people. And I like to write stories where I love that. What the fuck at the end of the first issue of a series? That's hopefully what every one of my readers does at the end of the first issue.
That was my experience with it. Yeah. And I'm excited to see where it goes. I guess this is, again, it's a franchise title, but you get to write it, like an original book where you have whole new characters, and it's just right. that horror element of having these non-talking aliens involved.
Yeah, and I mean, they're an important part of the story. I guess I can say this. They don't look like your average aliens, and there's a reason for that. I'm not sure that reason is ever really explained in Alien series, but it will be explained a little later on down the line. And it's still a good story, people. Crowd him by the comic. It's still a good. It's a good story. That's the important
thing. Yeah, it's a gorgeous book too. I really enjoyed it. I hadn't had a lot of other experience with Aliens comics, but saw your name on the cover and said I got to give this a shot, and I'm really glad I did.
Thank you. Yeah, and Zach's great, and you'll see more from that guy. He's insane. His stuff
excellent.
Is really really good. Yeah, and I can't remember the colorist's name. That's great. They'll love to hear that. It came out real nice looking. We're really really happy with it.
When you're doing, I guess, a licensed property like that, but you'd also said before, how you want to feel like you own a book. Does it feel like it's an uphill battle to start with? Because I imagine it would be challenging to be like, okay, I have to tell an alien story when, so many things have happened before, the movies that are seminal and even the comics that have come before there. Is that a big challenge, or do you feel like that stuff comes relatively easily?
Nothing I do is ever easy. I cannot stress that enough. Even if something that comes out there that you read and it sucks, trust me, the first draft was much worse. there is a 20th century Fox. Shouldn't it be 21st century Fox? No, well, anyway, Fox.
Living in the past.
They're actually, there's a joke there that I'm not going to touch. There's Fox has actually been pretty chill with what we do because we've been doing it for so long, or Dark Horse, I should say, has been doing it for so long. And I did write a series of alien stories for them back in the 90s, and man, by the third one, even though I was working with Richard Corbin, it was tough. Yeah, the thing that makes it, that balances that out is that, because, what makes it tough is that, it's all been done, But what balances that out is that all you need for the story is that they're aliens. You can create new characters, and if you can find something to do with the aliens that's different, all those characters, although you don't legally own them, they're yours, and you can write them the way you want to, And that balances that out. But yeah, it's in spite of the fact that Fox has trusted Dark Horse to tell these stories, you still find yourself second guessing yourself, I found that more with, I shouldn't really distinguish between the two, but I, you have to, you know, you watch the movies. The first two movies is what I always use for reference, and they work so well. Primarily, I'm committed to telling a story different from those stories. Ultimately, that's a little difficult because, you know, the aliens are coming to kill us is always going to be a major part of the story, you know. But hopefully the characters in them are motivated by for different reasons, and their dynamic, internal dynamic of whatever group is there is going to be different. So the short answer to your question is yes.
Yes. Well, excellent. That's a horror story, and BPRD, I guess, could be like a horror story, but it doesn't feel that. It's a little military. It's a little bit, you know, showing that nuts and bolts and stuff. What are the kind of stories that you like to write the most, that feel the most natural for you?
I guess I never really think about, you know, genre. I just want to tell stories about people, and if those people happen to be fish people, that's why maybe I'm not, you know, well, I shouldn't say that, but... I'm really interested in telling a story about people, whatever that story is. Like the thing that I did most recently, which hopefully we'll get to a little later on, that had to be about people, the Superman thing I did for Wednesday Comics, and that person in the story was Superman. But I didn't want to have to think about, like, you know, well, what would a guy who can shoot, you know, laser beams out of his eyes, what would his problems be? You know, I had to think about, well, he's a person. He lives on Earth. He's a person. He's an Earthling. He's a human, essentially. So what's that story? What's going to motivate him? And, you know, that I don't see a really huge difference between that story and the alien story, or you know, that story and the BPRD, or the alien story and the BPRD story. I just have to figure out a way to work elements of horror into those stories that, so that I can justify the genre marketing. but I find that most people just want to read stories, and sure. You know. Some people say, well, no, I want a horror story, or I want this story or that story. But I think you can sell a good story to anybody, you know.
Well, let's talk about Superman. You're doing the Superman feature in Wednesday Comics, and it's in strip format, which I'd be interested to know is, do you approach that differently? Is it sort of a challenge to sort of visualize how that looks, and, you know, you're not writing pages, you're writing, it's a larger format, so.
Yeah, it was a challenge, and it was a challenge that, honestly, I initially didn't take very seriously until I started writing it, and then I realized how much fun it could be, and before I turned in any pages, I approached it very differently, because, you know, when Mark Chirillo and I were first talking about this, he said, well, it's kind of like, you have to think of it as sort of like, you know, two pages of story per page, and then as soon as I started writing it, I realized, well, that's not really true, you know, because it's more like a page and a half, but really it's not like anything, you know? It's not like anything else I've done. It's got to be something that, you know, it's got to have a beginning and end to it that will keep the reader wanting to come back next week and not confuse the reader when he does come back next week. And it was a blast. It was a blast. It was so much fun working. It was a challenge that was hard but fun. And man, when I got Lee's first page, it's like, fuck, you know.
you've gotten a lot of pages back over the years, I guess. And as like, I'm somebody who's just starting to work on getting comics made and things like that. And when I get pages back, it's like, this is amazing. But I wonder, you know, when's this going to wear out? So you still can get that feeling when you get pages back?
Well, it's just, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's some things I'm working with Lee, and I don't want to single him out because I work with a lot of really good guys. You know, I'm working with John Severin, and every time I get a page, it's like, we get about a page a week or every 2 weeks from John, and they're all just gorgeous. I can't believe the guy, after 70 years of being in this business, still draws as well as he does. But because this format was so different, I didn't know how Lee was going to take to it, you know. I know that Lee's great, but I didn't know how Lee was going to take to it. And I knew it was going to look good, but I didn't know it was going to look this good. I mean, it's just, talk about synergy and talk about the collaborative effort really paying off. Lee is just spectacular. I think the combination of the format and Superman and if I do say so, a good script has just come together, and Lee is, he's transformed this story into something even better than it was when it started. And that's what you want. That's why I love collaboration. You know, when it doesn't work, it just pisses you off. But when it works, I just can't say enough about how Lee's work has really made this script, has made this story the best story it could be, maybe even better. And it's just spectacular. His stuff is, his Superman is, that's the best Superman ever, just the really wholesome Superman who's still intimidating. You don't see that, you know, you just don't see that.
Now, for people who don't know, is the Superman in Wednesday Comics, these are just standalone stories, so this would be, you know, typical Superman in Metropolis, or?
I try to cover all, because, you know, it's for everybody, theoretically. Mm-hmm. I try to cover all of the sort of classical settings for Superman. You know, you want to see Metropolis, you want to see Smallville, you want to get a peek at Krypton. But it's not completely removed from the present day mythology of Superman, such as he is, but it's removed from the present day continuity. If you need me to clarify. Just ask me, but it's, you know, you don't have to worry about all the continuity that's going on right now. The idea was that if Superman currently has a broken arm, we didn't have to worry about that. It was just telling a Superman story with the main characters in such a way that hopefully will illuminate who Superman is as a real hero, you know. Mm-hmm.
Now you're doing. Yesterday I just read your USA Comics special from Marvel. Let me ask you: do you ever run out of ways to put Nazis in comic books?
I hope not. that was Bill Roseman actually approached me, the editor, with doing a Mighty Destroyer story, and you know, you can't do a Mighty Destroyer story without Nazis, so that was his reason to exist. But he was the one who wanted to illuminate why he wears that silly costume, and that's what, you know, he gave me the ending. I just had to get there. Mm-hmm. But even if he hadn't given me the ending, you know, if I'm going to do a Mighty Destroyer story, it's you've got Nazis.
Yeah.
And let's face it, you know, it's getting harder and harder to find, you know, bad guys who aren't sympathetic. So, you know, nobody likes a Nazi.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, some people do, but, you know. Well,
they're just trains full of Nazis. It's.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but, you know. You can't kill a train full of almost anybody else anymore without maybe being like that a bit much, you know. But you know, no one's gonna squawk if you kill a train full of Nazis, you know. Except maybe David Duke. But you know, they're good bad guys to have around, you know.
So it must be an interesting challenge. Going from BPRD, where you have like a long serialized story, to doing something like this where it's a one shot, and then, you know, Superman in the Wednesday comics where it's little chapters in strip form. Have you found that, you know, is there any one particular style that you like, or do you like mixing it up?
I like mixing it up. I will say that the USA annual was a challenge. Because I was so used to telling, you know, five-issue stories. The Superman was different, and maybe it was because the format was different that I had so much more fun with it, that I took the challenge it just was more fun. The USA Comics one was like, shit, you know, I got to do this in only 22 pages. I got to tell a whole story in only 22 pages. Plus, you know, it's not like a Captain America story where everybody knows who he is. I got to introduce this character to people, and then I have to tell a story. It was a real challenge. I rewrite like crazy, but I rewrote that thing like 8 fucking times. You know, hopefully it doesn't show.
It seemed fairly effortless, just to come back around.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, and it seemed like, you know, when we have the backup, you know, issue with the reprint from, you know, the older Destroyer story, and it just reminds you just like how much they can pack into, you know, a single issue of a comic book. It's a lot of action in both, you know, the older one and your story.
Yeah, that's I really wanted to be, you know, wall to wall action, and still tell a story, and that's always a challenge. It's less of a challenge when it's the Hulk, because, you know, it's the Hulk. But the Destroyer, you know, nobody knows who that is. So you got to introduce this guy. You got to tell his origin, and then his motivations have to be very clear, all in 22 pages. And but it, you know, was ultimately that was a little harder than some, for whatever reason. I don't think it was the Nazis. I can tell you that right up front. I'm not gonna lie to you.
That's a gimme.
But ultimately it was a lot of fun, and I was happy that I was able to give Steve Ellis, the artist, so much action, you know, because I was afraid that wasn't going to work out that way. You know, it's tough.
So are there any other projects we should look forward to? Anything we need to talk about?
Well, there's Aliens versus Predator coming out after.
That's a lot of aliens and predators.
Yeah, this alien story and this predator story are dovetailing into an aliens versus predator story.
Okay, cool.
There's the Edward Gray Witchfinder story, the Western that I'm doing with John Severin, which I don't know when that's coming out. Whenever Sev finishes, and we don't, you know, we don't crack the whip with Sev. He just turns in the pages when he finishes them.
That's,
you know.
Let's back up. That's a Witchfinder Western?
Yeah, Edward Gray comes over to the States, I think it's like circa 1880, 1881, and he comes to the Old West looking for, it's not old to him, the West, looking for one of the characters from the Heliopic Brotherhood, and adventure ensues.
This is my new most anticipated project.
Oh, dude, man.
I'm very much looking forward to that. That's going to be great.
It's gorgeous. It's gorgeous. The first couple of pages that we got, I fell off my fucking chair. I swear to God, it's so beautiful. And Dave Stewart's coloring it, so, you know he's going to do... He's going to do Sev justice.
Well, the Severin pages that were in the, forgive me, that was the BPRD special.
The War on Frogs?
Yeah, but, I mean... Okay. It was really amazing to me that a guy who's been around that long, I can't think of anybody else who's still, I guess it's turning in pages that look, you know, who's been working that long and is still turning in pages that look as contemporary, or at least as effective as a contemporary artist does.
Yeah, no, you don't know anybody like that.
There isn't
anybody. And I got to tell you, man, that the Western pages, I mean, this is what he wants to do, and I thought those Warren Frog. I was delighted to have him do that Warren Frog story. I was, but the story, the Western story, is better, and John's artwork is better. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe how much better these pages were than what he did on Warren Frog. You know, I'll give you an example, and I should talk about something else, but it just can't. It blew my mind when I got the pages. There's a stagecoach. Of course, in the first couple of pages, and I get these pages, and he's, you know, the stagecoach is, I don't have to send him reference, you know, the rear boot is on it, the oat bucket hanging under the oat slash water bucket is hanging under the rear boot, all that shit's there, but more importantly, the stagecoach, and anybody else is going to have it drawn by four or six horses, right? And you get it, and not only does Sev have it being drawn by mules, but he's so fucking good, you can tell they're mules. You know, like some guys, they draw a horse, they draw a mule, it just looks like a cat with big ears. His mules are like, from behind, you can tell they're mules. It just is a huge, huge pleasure working with him. Right now, working with John Severin and Libra Mayo, I just could not be happier. I could not be happier. There's one other thing, though, I should tell you about that's coming out next year from Wildstorm. It's a graphic novel that I did a few years back with Peter Snyberg.
Nice.
The guy.
Oh, great.
Is that how you say it?
Yes, that's how you say it, Snyberg.
Wow. I've been getting that wrong for a long time. Anyway.
And it's colored by Bjarne Hansen. So, again, I mean, I'm working with Mike Mignola and Guy Davis, Libra Mayo, John Severin, Peter Snyberg, and Bjarne fucking Hansen, you know, one of the two best colorists in the business, and the best, I think, over Peter stuff. And it's coming out from Wildstorm next summer. I can't tell you more about it than that, but it's been a long road.
Yeah.
We finished it a while back, and we're just trying to find a way to get it out there. And finally, Wildstorm put together a way to get it out there, so we're really happy about that.
Now, on top of all this, I got to throw out a shout out to my alma mater, Drexel University. You're going to be teaching there in the fall, right? You're going to be teaching comic scripting.
That's right, in September. I don't know why I'm saying this, because I think, you know, everybody's going to sign up for it, probably already has, but it's a 10-week course, and I'll by the end of that course, I will have, or you will fail, a 22-page comic script out of you, and you know you'll leave there knowing how to do it. At least the day you leave, you'll know. After that, it's up to you.
Are you going
to
tell all those poor bastards there's no real jobs for them?
You know, there's no real jobs for them anywhere, brother. So I don't see any point in disappointing them about comics. You know, you go into investment banking, you go into computer programming, you go into IT, you're fucked.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, you know, you might as well be fucked doing something you love.
And without giving away, you know, your whole curriculum here, but do you have any advice for anybody, you know, looking to get into comics?
Stick with it.
Stick with it.
My favorite quote ever about this sort of thing comes from John Cougar Mellencamp. I'm not particularly fond of his music. I don't hate him, but I heard an interview with him, and I forget who it was. Some Fresh Air, so it was probably Terry Gross, but I don't know. Maybe it wasn't. Who knows? Anyway, this woman said to him, let's just say Terry Gross, what the hell, you know? No one's going to go check. She says, oh, so, you know, you've been in this a long time, you know, to what do you attribute your success? And Mellencamp says perseverance, and Terry laughs, and she goes, well, lots of people persevere. And he says, no, they don't. And he's right, they don't. If you give up, you have a 100% chance of failure. I know some people out there who aren't in comics, who are doing stuff that nobody ever gave them a shot at succeeding at, but, you know, they stuck with it, and they found their niche. And really, you know, if you want to do it, the only way it gets done is if you do it. Don't bitch and moan about it. Just do it.
So you hear that? Put down the headphones and get out there and write some pages.
And that may sound cliche, but I'm telling you, man, everybody gives up. If you don't give up, you're ahead of 99% of the pack. Everybody gives up. Nobody, you know, everybody wants to play guitar when he's a teenager. Nobody fucking ever does it. You know, everybody joins a gym in January. I can tell you from just watching them, you know, winnow away, by June, they're all gone. You know, just stick with it. It's hard, but so what? It's harder hating yourself.
That's true. It sounds like such a cheesy and poetic way to end a show, but also good.
Well, it is cheesy, but, you know, the reason anybody else ever says it is because it is true.
Yeah,
you know?
Fair enough.
And the beauty of it is, you know, I never feel threatened, because I know most people are going to give up anyway. So I never feel threatened at my job, you know? And that's something else that I think people should keep, you know, in the back of their minds, you know? So I guess we covered everything.
Well, all right there, the world. That's it for our Talk Explode with John Arcudi. I hope you enjoyed it. I'd like to thank John once again for sitting down and talking to us about all these great books. I, for one, am very excited for Wednesday Comics, the return of BPRD, and that crazy Witchfinder Western he was talking about. So a lot of things to look forward to. That's it for us here at ifanboy.com. Remember to check out the regular weekly Pick of the Week podcast and all the daily commentary and discussion going on over at ifanboy.com. Now get back to work. We don't want this anymore.